Good morning. It's good to see everyone out, and we all remembered to do our clocks the right direction, and for the most part, I think we're all here this morning, so it's good to see everyone. Okay, where was I? I left off with my study in Titus back in January before we did our pause for the month of February, so I had to go back and remind myself where I had been the last time I had spoken, and basically, I had begun in chapter 2 of Titus. We had studied the first 10 verses the last time I was up here. And Paul had commanded Titus to teach the things that were found in verse 10. They were consistent with, you know, sound approaches to the doctrine. Things that we all can find ourselves in one of these roles that Paul had talked about. Older men were to be self-controlled and they were to be sound in the faith. Older women were to reflect godliness and present godliness in their lives. They were to control their tongue. And maybe most importantly, they were to teach the younger women, you know, how to do these things and how they were to love and, you know, yield to their husbands. And then young men were to be models of good works and be sound in their speech. So with those 10 verses and with those kind of exhortations that Paul had given to Titus, we now can look at verses 11 through 15, and here Paul explains why these things are important, why these different age groups need to be doing what they were asked to do. In verse 11, it says, "For the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people." It's kind of an interesting turn of a phrase there, that grace has appeared, almost as if grace was a person. You can't see the grace of God, but yet we're told that it appeared. It was visible. Well, in this case, there is a person, and this person did bring salvation to everyone. This grace that appeared clearly is being applied to Jesus, who came and did appear to those that day, And he did bring the grace of God into the world, and with that came about the salvation that comes along with the grace of God. Essentially, we shouldn't forget who we are and what we are to be doing. And what I mean by that is we may be living Christian lives, we may be striving to do God's will, but down deep, we're all sinners. We all have sinned. We all are not perfect. And we have broken God's laws countless times through our lives. And so we all are in need of this grace. We all have the need for the salvation. And on the flip side, we need these things because we are all deserving of God's wrath and the punishment that comes from breaking his law. We are deserving of that and a penalty of death and torment for eternity awaits those that do break God's law. But rather than this arrival of God's wrath, Jesus came to this earth and he appeared and brought God's grace with him instead. Not wrath, but grace. The death that we deserve is overridden by God's grace that brought salvation to all. And the emphasis should be placed on the word all. There's no one that doesn't fit into this category. We are all able to take advantage of the opportunity that's given to the whole world for salvation. No one is excluded. It doesn't matter how heinous of a life you've lived, you know, done terrible things in your life. It doesn't matter what mistakes you've made in your past. Everyone is able to receive the salvation that appeared when Jesus came to this earth. The atonement of Jesus is not limited. It's offered to all to freely take and to accept. We then transition into verse 12, training us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in the present age. So the grace of God teaches and trains us how to live our lives. The grace of God is there to train, is to condition us to say no to this ungodliness that's referenced here in verse 11, the worldly passions that are mentioned there. When we see the grace of God as seen through Jesus' coming and his living on a perfect life on this earth and for his death on the cross, we need to respect that. We need to see that that salvation that came about through that sacrifice is worthy of our attention. It's worthy of our acceptance. We sin when we forget that. When we forget what Jesus did for us, and that what God did by sending his son to this earth to die for us, we sin when we don't focus on that. And so we have to keep that in mind, in our forefront of our mind at all times. Anything that is against God is not good for us. We have to say no. The grace of God, if we fully appreciate it, can be used as a tool in our lives to help us say no to that ungodliness, to say no to those worldly passions that we're warned about in verse 12. Basically, the grace of God is there to help teach us to live a faithful life. We see Jesus treating others the way that they should be treated. Instead of being compassionate, giving, and treating others fairly, oftentimes as an imperfect human, we don't do what other people should have done for them. We don't think about the well-being of others many times. We only act on what serves us best, what is in our best interest. But Jesus, and by bringing the grace of God with him, shows us that that's not the right way to behave, that we have to be upright in our dealings with others. We must be fair to others. We must be kind to others. We must care about others. We have to have compassion about those in our lives and those that we come across. And that all boils down to is that it's just about being thoughtful. And thoughtful is not just a word. Thoughtful means that you are looking for things beyond your own interest. You're looking out for people. You're looking to see what you can do for others. And he goes on and says that this grace of God also teaches us to be godly. The picture here is very simple. We need to look like God. Now, of course, we've never seen God, but through his word, we certainly get a picture of the type of lives that we should be living. Jesus, we haven't seen, but others did. They saw the life that he lived. They saw the example that he set as he lived his life on earth. And we need to live that same type of life, that caring, thoughtful, compassionate life that Jesus brought about. And that is a good way kind of to wrap our heads around what it means to be godly. It's not the omnipotent part. It's not the omnipresent part. It's the caring. It's the loving. And it's the thoughtfulness part that we need to adopt into our lives that the grace of God teaches us about being godly. Going on to verse 13, it says, "Waiting for our blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ." As we live in godliness, as we live an upright life within self-control and live a godly life, we should be waiting for something else. We are awaiting this second coming of Jesus back, to this earth. We make these life changes because we have a hope. And Paul mentions it here. It's a blessed hope. And that should be something that molds our lives. Now, we use hope today in a way that is different than how the biblical writers were using hope. When we use hope in our world today, we're talking about really about something we wish would happen. I hope I get a raise. I hope my loan goes through for that house I'm buying, or I hope no one sits next to me on the plane. Small things, too, we can hope for. You like that elbow room on that plane. So our use today of the word hope really shows maybe a level of uncertainty. Yes, I hope no one sits next to me on the plane, but ultimately, if someone bought that ticket, there's not much I can do about it. But I can hope. I can wish for that to take place. So this level of uncertainty is, we show that we're not sure that any of that will happen, but the biblical writers didn't use the word hope in that way. They use the word hope to speak of something that is to be expected. We hope for something. We look forward to something to happening. And it's not a wish. It's not any level of uncertainty is found in that wish. Hope is something you know with certainty is going to happen. And all you're doing now is just waiting for it to happen. This is the idea. There's no doubt of or any degree of uncertainty that Jesus will return. He's going to return, and he's going to appear with great glory. And we just have to wait for it. We're told that when this great return does happen, the dead in Christ will rise, and those who are alive on the earth will be caught up in the air to meet Jesus there. And so we'll be united to Jesus, and we will see the glory of his return. Believe me, no one's going to miss that. It's going to be something that everyone is going to be able to witness. Those who've died in the Lord will not miss it either. Though they're dead, they will rise in the air to meet with Jesus. And so we will meet with Jesus, we will unite with Jesus, but hopefully we will be reunited with those in our lives that have gone before us and that have already lived a godly life, an upright life, a compassionate life, and they will rise and meet Jesus. So we can take courage that we have this hope that that day will arrive. Verse 14 continues, "Who gave himself for us to redeem us from all lawlessness and to purify for himself a people for his own possession who are zealous for good works." A lot in that verse to unpack. That's a lot of different ideas and concepts and thoughts in that verse. So let's split it up a little bit. So far we've seen what's going to happen. The grace of God has appeared. The grace of God has taught us and has shown us the way to live a godly life, that we can use that grace to help us overcome the worldly passions that are in the world. And we are to adopt the attributes that are described in the first 10 verses. While we're doing this, we are hoping, waiting for the great return of our Lord. But we have to then also realize what Jesus has done for us. And what that is that he gave himself to redeem us from the iniquities, the lawlessness that's in our lives, that's mentioned here in verse 14. I did a sermon a few months back where I talked about the word redeem. Most kids today don't understand the idea of redeeming like a Top Value stamp collection or redeeming a glass bottles and get your 10-cent deposit back, carry those things from your car in. People don't necessarily realize that, but that's what redeeming is, and that's what Jesus did. He paid a price to set us free from these worldly passions and from these iniquities and lawlessness in our lives. But because he paid that price, the penalty that is due us for living ungodly lives and sinful lives is no longer going to apply to us. By redeeming us, he's forgiven that debt, but we're also told here that he purchased us. We are a possession of his. And so, wow, that is a typo. What did I type there? I have no idea what that word is. But I got a little dyslexic there. I misspelled the word. But if a price was paid, well, then there had to have been a cost. But what is the cost? I know when I took that glass bottle in, I would get 10 cents back. I knew that was the cost. That was the redemption value. But with sin, the price was quite staggering. It was, the phrase that he uses here is, who gave himself for us. Well, that's the cost. He gave himself. He gave his life. He sacrificed that life that he had on this earth to redeem us. And his price that he paid was the life. And he freely did it. He gave his life for us. But because he gave his life and he paid that price and he redeemed us, like I mentioned, we are no longer our own. Jesus has purchased us. Paul says he possesses us now. We used to be a slave to Satan, and the choices we made were our own. We chose to sin and have sin in our lives. But despite that, I should say, Jesus chose to redeem us anyway. He chose to pay the price and die for us and to release us from that slavery of sin. We are no longer our own, but we belong to Him. So people so often talk about what they want to do, but that is not ours to decide because we no longer own ourselves. We are beholden to Him and to do His will. And we are no longer the one in charge of our lives if we have the proper mindset. We submit ourselves freely to a godly life. Jesus paid the price with two expectations that we find here in this verse. One is that we are to be a purified person. If you think about something that's purified, it's either cleaned or refined, you know, with fire, something along those lines. There's lots of different ways things can be purified. But now that He's purified us through the grace that He brought and the salvation that we've accepted, we need to stay that way, to be purified. I wash my car once, and the next day it rains or snows or something, and it's not purified any longer. Well, we can't have that in our lives. We have to stay in a purified state. We can't go right back into the slavery of sin from which He had purchased us. I went through this about, I don't know how the proper word, I don't know how upset Jesus gets, but I mean, Jesus doesn't appreciate us, is probably the best way of doing it, for us to see us go right back into a life of sin after we have chosen to become His possession. We are to be, once we're purified, we are to stay purified. We're supposed to live a life that is free from the slavery of sin. And we are to be different because we belong to Him now. And secondly, we find in this verse that we are to be zealous for good works. We have to be on fire. And we need to ask ourselves, as we sit here, I stand here today, are we on fire? Are we zealous? Do you think you would classify yourself on fire? Would you classify yourself as being on fire for and zealous for good? Or are you mildly interested, somewhat concerned? That's what we have to ask. If you find yourself just mildly interested, well, we have to be on fire, and you can get that fire back, and you can do that by starting to do works, good works on His behalf. Let's put this back to the forefront of our mind. Let's place it, you know, our intentions to be this way, to be on fire. You say to yourself, I'm going to be pure, I'm going to stay pure, and I'm going to be on fire for the Lord. I've been redeemed. The grace of God has appeared, and I no longer have any other alternative but to be purified and to be zealous. And then Paul closes this part of the chapter, verse 15, by saying, declare these things, exhort and rebuke with all authority, let no one disregard you. So we need to look at how Paul is wrapping up these thoughts with Titus. The first 10 verses where he's talking about the different roles that we have and so forth, he now tells Titus, declare it. I think when you go to other countries and you go in, you know, through immigration, you declare anything that you're bringing back. They want to make sure you don't bring those awful fruit from one country to another. They want you to tell them what it is you have that you may be bringing back with you. Well, that's what Paul is saying. Declare it. Make it known. Tell others about this. You need to tell others that God's grace has come, that they need to then be purified and be a possession of Jesus's. We need to tell everyone that they can do it. They're not excluded. Everyone has this opportunity of salvation, and this grace is offered to them, and that we all should be what God has called us to be in the first 10 verses and then through these additional verses here. But just don't tell them about it. It says here in verse 15, We are to help them. We are to exhort and rebuke. Exhorting, of course, means to challenge them, to encourage them to do what they need to be doing. Tell them we have this hope of God and his return, Jesus' return, but we can't give up. We have to be diligent. We have to be strong, and we have to base our lives with that hope in our lives. And then it says we need to rebuke them. It's not a suggestion. We need to do it. As we see others struggling, we need to bring them back. We don't just let them. If we see someone driving and they're veering off to the right, if we're in the passenger seat, we'll say, hey, get back over. Get back in our lane. That's how we need to treat others. As we're seeing maybe others struggling with something, just don't sit idly by and say, oh, well, they'll correct on their own. No, we need to encourage them. We need to exhort them, and we need to rebuke them. We need to bring this to their attention before they get totally out of control. So we need the older men of this church to be what we read in verse 2. We need the older women to be exactly what Paul talks about in verses 3 and 4. The younger women are to be doing what the older women have mentioned to them and taught them in verse 5. And then the younger men that are what's found in verses 6 through 8, they need to be doing those things. I'm sure we all can find ourselves in one of these age groups. We all have a role in the life of others and in the life of this church. We have a part to play in this plan. And that's the overarching message of chapter 2 of Titus, that we all have a role, and we're given instructions here on the attitudes and the different mindsets that we need to have to help us succeed and help those around us succeed in living that and being that purified possession of the Lord. Next week, well, in 2 weeks, we will conclude with chapter 3 of Titus, and we'll finish that study. But as of right now, we'll ask Brother Paul to lead us in a word of prayer, and then we'll begin our class.